Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Yes Indeed podcast, created by Mark Shepard and run by me, Thomas Manuel. Today, we're sitting down with Max Lander and Aaron King, the two hosts of the RPFM podcast, which is an RPG book club podcast where every episode, Max and Aaron read a game and then critically analyze it. RTFM stands for Read the Fucking Manual, but not fucking manual as in like the Kama Sutra, but more like, this book is annoying. You know, anyway, RTFM is a wonderful podcast. In a world full of podcasts where two people sit and talk to each other, it's a podcast in which the two people talking to each other are extremely interesting. I almost never agree with their opinions, but I still respect them. Even when I disagree with them, I tend to learn something from how they look at games. I think this episode is a great showcase of where Max and Aaron are coming from as critics and why you should be listening to them. It seems to be a year for having multiple guests on at once. We did that with Hannah and Evan from Design Doc. We'll be doing that again next week. If you'd like to support the show and help me get more and more people on, please head over to patreon.com/indierpg. I would really appreciate it. Yeah, with that, let's get to the interview. All right. I am sitting down with Max and Aaron from the RTFM podcast. Maxwell Lander is a game designer, photographer, visual artist, and also a musician with an album of Dungeon Synth on Bandcamp called A Monstrous God, which I listened to yesterday and it was very good. He publishes games as Huge Boar Games, which includes titles like Himbos of Myth and Metal, an old school inspired fantasy game where the characters are big where it matters. Aaron King is a game designer whose works include Speedrune, a heartfelt retro clone of another game about questing for runes, and Patchwork World 6th Edition, a PBTA fantasy game which, like all Aaron's work, is experimental, literary, and playful. Sadly, like the plays of Sophocles, the first 5 editions of Patchwork World have been lost to the missiles. They are both the co-hosts of RTFM and RPG Book Club podcast, and that's what we're going to talk about mostly today. Aaron and Max, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm good. I'm happy to be here.
We sound so fancy. It's weird to be on this side of things. I always find it fascinating when other folks, like, what people highlight of the stuff you've done. I always feel a little like, oh, I did stuff. I feel cool.
So let's talk about RTFM. It started out as a podcast where you were both reading older games and discussing them, Cyberpunk 2020, GURPS, Gamma World, and now you're discussing newer games, but going back to that initial decision to start a podcast, what was the thing that got you excited to do it in the first place?
I think, honestly, it started as, one, I have all these RPGs I haven't read, but two, we need to make an excuse to hang out. We had played a few games over Discord. This was like the start of the pandemic, and just clicked and decided, like, let's do some project together. Let's make a reason to spend more time together. And so initially, maybe this is not true, but initially the books were secondary almost. And it was just a reason to get together every couple weeks and gossip about RPGs, I guess.
Yeah, it's weird to think of the beginning of it because it feels so long ago. And also, I feel extremely close to you, Aaron, having never but all of that closeness has developed largely in the time of the podcast existing. Like, we didn't know each other well or long before it started, and it definitely was, I think we think similarly about games. I think on my end, I feel pretty confident now saying that this is also part of Aaron's interest, but I was like, I like the opinions you have. I like talking to you about your opinions, especially as they pertain to games. And yes, we also do have bookshelves of ancient games that we need an excuse to read and not talk about. I mean, for me, it was also, and not talk about with the internet, because they're games that have like large fan bases that I don't want to interact with in any way, shape, or form. Like, we were always really aware we wanted to like have you know, personal and political critique be a part of it. And that's not often how a lot of those old games are kind of interacted with. So for me, there was definitely a like, this feels like a safe space to have these conversations that maybe is going to be overly critical of people's favorite.
Right. We don't want to talk to the person that's been playing Traveller since 1979 or whatever. I mean, as informative, I personally would want to talk to that person, but not maybe in a recorded format and not in a way to like critique or understand Traveller.
I love this idea that the two of you were just, I'd like to hang out with the other person and hear their opinion about games. But, and also the second part about like, you know, maybe these conversations are hard to have in a public space or on social media, I guess, specifically. Okay, let's talk about the second one first. When you started the podcast, were you worried at all about having these opinions in public? Because I know that's something that I think about a lot, you know, especially when you're critiquing, like you said, games that have fan bases. But even now, when you're discussing newer games, that doesn't go away, right?
We were right from the get-go. That was part of the safety net of we're going to talk about old games.
Yeah.
Originally was we're going to talk about games that are probably not being published anymore, that their creators might not even be alive, let alone like still involved in the scene. Probably they're never going to hear us, but also games that were like Star Wars doesn't care what we think of it.
Yeah.
You know, like D&D doesn't care what we think of it. These like bigger games that there's no world in which anything we could say could have an impact on that. And I think that's changed a little bit for both of us, because an inverse thing happened where we still ended up like having conversations around games that we didn't think were great with communities that we didn't like. We still tended to attract the, I don't know. I don't, maybe I'm saying a thing I'm not supposed to say out loud, but I feel like in the beginning we have like a really great community and I really like our community and they're super good. And I feel like a lot of when we were starting up on Twitter, a lot of the attention would be like people who have been playing GURPS for 50 years or whatever, obviously not 50 years, but, and our intention was to like have a safe space to like critically engage with those things. And then what that meant was a little bit that our audience became people who weren't critically engaging with that. And which is part of the pivot towards newer games and smaller games is like, if we're going to, I think we can critique things lovingly. And I think originally it was less lovingly because it was ancient games usually that were like really racist or whatever. Like there were a couple games that we had planned to talk about that we didn't because they were just so racist that we weren't comfortable putting them on the podcast. Some people really like those games still. They are questionable humans. And I think we kind of, at least for me, I started to feel like we were, even though we were critiquing them, we were still promoting them. And I wanted to be more aware of what it is that we are talking about and what gets attention and kind of the idea of like having a responsible engagement with having a voice while still wanting to like maintain our ability to keep honest because we're not. I think it's very important to both of us that we're very honest about our reactions to things, but we've pivoted more towards wanting to highlight games that we think need more attention, even if they don't end up hitting for us, you know?
It's also like, also just in the, like on the content production side, it is easy to read a 300 page book and find an hour's worth of discussion. With a 24 page zine, I will enjoy that reading experience more, but often I find myself just having to say like, this was good. I liked it. Here's two things I liked. It's perfect. That's what I want, but it doesn't kind of spur that back and forth. Or it is, you know, it's harder to do a close reading. You know, people can make graduate theses from a novel much easier, I think, than from a single poem. Usually with a poem, you're looking at a poet's whole body of work. Maybe that's what we do, is we have to read like 10 zines by the same person.
Anybody who's made 10 zines.
Yeah.
Next season.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just a weird thing too. I mean, I am a frequent reader of the RPG subreddits as a form of, I guess, self-punishment and self-hatred. And there's always people looking for suggestions for games. And there's always kind of the same 20 games that get mentioned for just about any questions.
Yeah.
And some of those games were ones we were covering. And I like that we covered them. And I like that we went a little deeper than a couple sentence Reddit recommendation. But no one needs to know that Numenera exists. Like, they don't need us to tell them that Numenera exists. They see that everywhere else. No one needs to have GURPS explained to them necessarily. And so we are hoping to pivot more toward newer games, smaller games, harder to find games. Like, I think we're both still very open to, like, if we find some weird old thing that does not get recommended, I would love to read that. I really enjoyed our episode on the Rules of Dungeon, Minneapolis Dungeon, which is like this recently rediscovered kind of first hack, almost based on someone hearing about D&D instead of reading it. And so, you know, old stuff like that, the game's archaeology, as Will Yobst calls it, intrigues me still. But I think I am more interested in older games than Max is, or more interested in kind of finding little bits that work for me. I sometimes feel like I'm inflicting things like Traveler on Max. And he's very patient with me in that.
You're just more positive than I am. You walk away from a book that is like 300 pages with like your little bundle of 10 pages that you found really valuable. And I am being dragged into the abyss by the remaining 290 pages. And I think like, I still like some of the old stuff. Part of that was also me having less exposure to the history of RPGs and wanting to like understand where some of those conventions come from.
Yeah.
And even like, I'm also, I say this on the podcast a lot, but I think I'm more like mechanically interested than Aaron also. So wanting to know like a little bit more where those like design conventions come from. And some of those episodes were great. Like Gamma World was a hoot and all of the episodes were enjoyable, but Gamma World was like, oh, this game is very compelling. This game is really interesting. There's so much going on here that I want to dig into. And so I like that because I do think there is a lot of little golden nuggets to find in there. I think as we go on, I have been pushing, not against Aaron. Aaron has been fully game for all of this, for like, the level of critique that I think we want to engage in is really fun when you can tell that the designers of the games are also engaging in that level of critique in their design. Like, those are really nice moments for me when you can be like, this is so intentional, and you can see all this like thought process and intentionality and statement and viewpoint in a game, which I think is not always present in the older ones, that we're really like replicating a specific format. And so that balance of back and forth between those I find very interesting.
And then sort of sideways from that too, like, we did a RuneQuest episode where we barely talked about the contents of RuneQuest, and it became an episode about citing sources and the ownership of material and hobby versus industry and stuff like that. And I was kind of worried, like, oh no, are people going to listen to this wanting RuneQuest and walk away disappointed? But I've seen multiple people recommend that episode in other contexts, like, that they don't even know I'm there. And just as like an example of a discussion they enjoyed about kind of the ideas that are the backdrop to these games. And so I think the show has evolved where we might cover older games like that, but in a more bird's eye view or a topical, almost essayish discussion of something that informs the game instead of the mechanics or the prose or anything like that.
Are we cultural critics?
Well, and I think the other funny thing is, like you said, like, we have similar thoughts on games. And I think generally that in certain ways that's really true. But I also think like we have sort of disparate backgrounds or approaches to critique that I think work really well together as like a discussion-based show, but I don't think we approach these books the same. We don't have the same like educational background or reading background. And I like that. I think it makes for a better time. I don't know.
I think we are philosophically aligned about what we think critique should do. And I think that matters quite a lot at any moment in which we are coming from different. Like, I think those differences don't have a negative impact because of that kind of central core of like,
right,
we are united in purpose or some such nonsense.
I'm glad we're here. I feel the two of you do have sort of different approaches, but like you're both saying that they're very compatible approaches, right? That like you have maybe different interests or different focuses, So since you've been doing this for 2 years, and I'm sure there is a kind of rapport or rhythm that's developed between the two of you, do you have a sense of what you will bring up versus what the other person will bring up? Like when you're reading a text, is that like automatically something that pops into your head?
We often have we have a chat thread constantly. And so oftentimes before recording an episode, we do put up like, oh, I just want to make sure I remember to talk about this or stuff like that. But then there also is always a component of like, save it for the podcast. Don't discuss it in the chat. Also, I have definitely read something and thought, oh, Max is going to get pissed at this in a really excited way.
More often than not, I will read a thing and be like, oh, I bet Aaron likes this. And then every once in a while, yeah, I will be completely shocked by your response to something. And I think those moments are some of my favorites. Where I'm like, well, Aaron's going to like this. And then Aaron's like, no, I hated that. That was the worst thing I've ever read. And I'm like, oh, I thought that was your chance. Okay, no, great. Yep, whatever. And so I do sometimes, I feel like generally we have a good sense about whether or not we're going to like love or hate a book as we're reading it. But every once in a while, things come out of left field. I think some of those do end up being some of the more interesting episodes, or I would imagine. Aaron doesn't listen to the episodes. I have to listen to them to edit them. So I could be editing anything into the episodes and Aaron would not know.
When you submitted us to the Ennies, it was just like all you and our guests talking with me just saying weird things to bookend the start and the end. And so I do like that there are people out there, the Ennies judges, and to them, I'm like the sidekick that says strange things on a shock jock radio show while you are discussing something intelligently with a guest.
You have so many good one. I'm very bad at having like thematic one-liners, and I feel like you come out with so many of them that I felt like I really needed to capture that energy.
I think going beyond whether, you know, the other person will like a game or not, I'm interested in what, like, how you would describe, like, your approach versus the other person's approach. First of all, like, do you have a way to articulate, oh, when I read a game, I read it in this way, I think about these things versus, you know, I think my co-host tends to think about this stuff and that's kind of synergistic or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is definitely that I feel like I am a little bit more mechanically focused than Aaron. Yeah. And Aaron is in every way, shape, and form a significantly better writer and reader than I am. So I do feel like
different.
Whatever. But so definitely when I'm reading a book, I am often, unless it's spectacular and like sweeps me away with its writing, which happens very infrequently, but does happen, I am usually trying to deconstruct some kind of interesting mechanic or try and figure out what it's trying to say on like a systems design level. Whereas Aaron can articulate this more, but Aaron is, I feel like, very vibe-based.
I dropped out of school 3 times. And so like for 3 years, I was a history major, and then I was doing English literature, and then I was doing library and informational sciences. And a lot of that stuff involves like getting use out of text no matter what. Like if you're a historian, like these primary texts from however long ago are going to be useful to someone to help them make something. If you're a librarian, like one of the laws of library science is every book, its reader. Like the book is for someone. Someone will want this book. And like when I was doing English studies, a lot of it was like, okay, read this book. And now I'm going to teach you about feminist theory, and I want you to critique this book through a feminist theory lens. And now read the same book over again, and I'm going to teach you about the Marxist lens, and I want you to talk about this book through the Marxist lens. And so you end up reading this book over and over, but being told to pull different things out of it. And so a lot of times when I'm reading a book for the show, I am just trying to find like, what's my beginning entry point into just being able to talk about this and hopefully be somewhat entertaining about it. Like I want to entertain myself. I hopefully want to entertain the listener. I want to learn something. And like, I want to make Max get mad while we record. because people like that as well. And so, you know.
I'm in my soft year. How dare.
It's true.
It's your turn to get mad this year.
But yeah, you know, the idea that a book has to mean a single thing, or that I have to weigh it on the scales at the end and define it with a single term or quality is like anathema to me. I am not into that. And so I just try to stay kind of flexible and look for something that I can take away from it.
Yeah, I feel like I'm definitely more, especially as time goes on, I think, which has more to do with where my, like where I'm at in my life and what my life looks like outside of RTFM. But I think I'm definitely more like game studies lens. And I do feel like Aaron sometimes is a little better at having a broad, like just media read. Like you can read media from a variety of different ways through a variety of different lenses. And I'm like, but game studies, what is it? What is a game doing? And that.
Yeah. And you are also like, you are maybe, if people don't know, like you are a professor of game studies. So like that probably needs to be said. And some of this is maybe sometimes against your own will, like professional development for you.
And what's funny is that I wasn't when we started this podcast. Right. And I do think that part of my ability to articulate what I find interesting and compelling in my own work and research is because of the podcast. Like it's because of the way we have actually engaged in kind of unintentionally, like a really intensive research project, right? Like, and now that it's 2 years standing, like that is a long time to be looking right at the same kind of content with any kind of analytical.
What did you say, longer than your first marriage?
It is longer than my only marriage, right. Thank you.
I guess I meant longer than your no longer extant marriage.
Yes, longer than my first marriage by a wide margin now. Add that to the trivia pile. Also, I have dropped it things more than once. So we have many dropouts between us. I refuse to say how many so that it remains a guessing game. But yes, I think I, especially as I kind of solidify into my role as a professor of games, there is more of an interest, even just personally, in like me wanting to articulate my own practice and doing that through kind of trying to dig into what other people are doing in their practice. But through the lens of like game making as a practice. Which is funny because the podcast started as a, we're going to read these like books, like not obviously they're game books, but like, you know, read them from cover to cover, talk about how they're written, talk about how they're structured as a game, as a book object, not just as a game object.
I think that's really interesting. So then at what point did this become, Max, to you, like something that became a part of a larger project? And like a personal practice, like was there a moment where you're like, this is now influencing me and the way I think, and which parts of it kind of, you know, had that effect or made you interested in that way?
When did someone finally offer you enough money to make games career and your life
full time? I mean, it, what's funny is that like I didn't realize this until recently, but I made my first game 10 years ago and it was a VR game. No, my first game was not a VR game. My second game was a VR game. But my first game was a FMV, a full motion video. And I don't think, even though I went to grad school for VR and tech stuff, I don't think I actually thought of games as something that I could engage with in any kind of serious way until relating to it through game studies and research practice, because I'm so against all of the ways that the industry manifests. And at the very least, certainly don't, even when I'm not against it, I don't really want to participate in it. And for a hot second last year, there was definitely a moment where I was like, Aaron, am I going to make this my real job? Like as a game maker at participating in game sales. And I think that very quickly the answer to that was, oh, no, I'll just quit games. But the podcast remained, like even in those, I think the really big, like the moment of realization for me is as my interest in making games kind of ebbed and flowed, my interest in the podcast did not. It maintained. And so, which is very telling about like, oh, I'm really interested in the research elements of this. I'm really interested in being involved in criticism and critique and analysis and design thinking around games, even when I wake up in the morning, I'm like, what if I never made another game? That'd be a great life. But I would still keep doing the podcast. And so I think it is a little bit in direct response to watching my own emotional relationship to what the reality of being a game maker who needs to survive off of the making of those games is. And I think in the content of the podcast has really highlighted some access points for me to continue that interest as far as like, again, and even down to like specifying language or areas of exploration that I can think of in a larger research project, or thinking about like, you know, design frameworks that are regular. Like I, you know, have been exposed to a number of different design frameworks and design philosophies and all of that through the podcast, a lot through Aaron, because Aaron has a lot more like, here's what the scene has produced for the last 10 years or whatever. And a lot of that content has really helped justify the games that I want to make. Like looking at games in this way, which is very explicitly and intentionally removed from their value as product and their value as commercial entity, but looks at them as much as we can as objects of culture and objects of art and creativity, was the way in which I was like, as long as I can keep focus on that lens and that realm of games and kind of push away the more capitalistic side of things, I can continue to find interest in this. I do want to engage in that being the thing that I contribute to as far as my labor, which I'm very privileged to be able to say that I can do, because I can be a professor and do that. And there are very few of those jobs in the world. But yeah, there was definitely a period where I was like, no, maybe I'm going to bounce and not make games. And that kind of critical analysis and games as art and games as a field, not as an industry, that I feel like we like to sit in a lot, really helped kind of solidify that direction.
And we talk about that, I mean, almost constantly, but like recently the Dice Exploder podcast had Alex Roberts on, and she just a single sentence eviscerated both of us and said, she was talking about something and she was like, well, but this was back when indie games was a community and not an industry. And I think both of us just went, oh, because that is something that we both, you know, we were coming up during the first like Zine Quest, and I was making stuff a little before that. And I, you know, I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I do a lot of local organizing and stuff. And so when I came to games, it was about like hanging out and sharing your zines and helping each other. And we have seen in the past 5 years a shift toward a lot of people trying to promote themselves. And I'm not opposed to people making money from their games. I think it's important labor. I love games. I value them. I want people to get what they need from making games, but I feel less interested in hanging out when it's a lot of kind of check out my new game, self-promotion stuff. Again, I have done all of these things that I'm criticizing. And so I'm not saying you who are doing this out there, listener, are bad. I'm saying a pendulum has swung one way. I would like it to swing back. But I think part of that is like, this was a podcast for us to hang out, and it will remain that. And it will remain hopefully more of a artistic or critical lens than a promotional lens.
Wow. I think that, you know, that's really clarified to me what I really love about RDFM, which is very specifically this thing, that you are focusing on these games as works of art, as works of culture. And once you agree to do that, then whatever way you approach it, that's fine, right? Like that's the compatibility, right? And I know in the context of an industry, in the context of people trying to make livings off it, this does make it or does separate it from a lot of the other conversation, right? Even if you read Shannon Appelklein's like history of the hobby, it's a business history. You know, it's a history of like these companies were successful with these products And these products were copied in this way because they were successful, you know, and there's a whole lot of like focus on these games are important for you to know about because they, like, these things are connected. They had a lot of players, but the thing under a lot of players is because they made money. And that's the only way to kind of like measure success. And there is a lack of discussion, I feel, constantly about games as just the thing that they are, right? Like as texts, as weird things we do at a table, like, you know, all that part of it, like even just the design part, which I'm sure some people also think that stuff is over discussed, right? Like people focus too much on what did the dice do. And I have some sympathy for that as well. Like, you know, it's either we talk about games in terms of the commercial context, or we talk about games specifically in terms of how do they describe what the dice do, and then yes, everything else. But like even the second thing is so rare compared to the first thing.
I've been thinking about this a lot because I straddle different games mediums, right? Yeah. Like because I sit over here and I do RTFM that is always analog, and I design analog games, and then I go to my job. And it's almost exclusively digital and video games and VR and the technology industry. And the conversation there is a little bit farther along. Like there's a broader conversation there just because there's such a larger like population engaged with like video games, right? Like it's just a way bigger industry. So of course you're going to get like different forms of critique and different websites popping up and whatever. But I do really interesting that somehow popularity has become the dictator of something being good. And I'm like, when did you not live through the 90s? What happened to counterculture? Like something being super popular to me means that it's probably not good. It's probably generically appealing, right? Like those things are inverse to me. And maybe that is like because I'm an angry queer or whatever. But like it is strange to me how in games there is this parallel between popularity and not even just like success, but like obviously popularity means commercial success, but like a success on a different level, value, good, you know, value equal good if player base equal over whatever. And I find that weird, usually just because I think of like, you know, mass engagement. Usually meaning like not having thoughtful content as the most, and it is always interesting. And I don't think that's necessarily like, I'm not saying all popular games are bad. It's just equating that popularity with it being good seems to be a weird thing that games do sometimes that I don't understand.
Well, I think part of it to me, at least, is that games, RPGs, tabletop analog RPGs are like such a new medium. They are 50 years old. And so, you know, if you look at comic books or photography, like some of our other newer mediums in the grand span of history, like the amount of time it took for like critical movement to develop around those mediums and for things to get stylized and like accepted as certain styles, like we're doing it right now. We're in the hotbed. It's a really exciting time. But also it is, like Max said, like kind of an annoying time where RPGs are getting a really big renaissance financially, economically, company-wise, and that can often be like a push against the more critical or long-term cultural lens of looking at them.
It can't be contentious to say that the commercialization of an art field has never served an art field. Like that can be a contentious.
Yeah,
like,
I don't know.
I don't know.
Like, I think about, like, the web comics explosion in the early 2000s, and more people were reading comics than ever before. And a lot of those comics, I think, were pretty bad, but it made them kind of culturally acceptable. And so then people started becoming professors of comic books or professional comic book makers at residencies and stuff like that. And so it is a push and pull. I think, you know, the Marvel movie of RPGs is not going to be something I'm interested in or want to hang out with. But I just, you know, I'm always thinking of like, well, maybe there's some 7-year-old who sees the Marvel movie of RPGs and then gets into the weird fucking French cinema of RPGs after that, and then becomes like the auteur in their 20s or whatever, who's making the next critical darling
You can play D&D until you're 12 years old, and then you have to move on.
Put away your childish things. Experience.
It has to be a gateway drug.
No, so the thing is, I do think that one of my favorite things is the reading of something historical or sociopolitical into something that is considered low art, right? Like, you know, it being high art is not the thing that appeals to me. When someone goes like, oh, this is the ecological like critique of Pokemon, I'm like, yes, tell me more. Tell me, like, give that stuff to me, you know? Like, I mean, one, because I think we can only critically engage with the things that we're actually engaging with, right? Like, the problem, you know, is if somebody is writing something that uses, say, some gallery work that I have not seen or I have not engaged with, like, you know, I can't be interested in it to some extent. You need to draw me in. The problem is not that certain kinds of art are popular. The idea is that people are not doing the second part, which is the part right. where you discuss the popular art and you try to go from there into something that is like more interesting to discuss than, say, like, which Pokemon is the best. Like, you know, like, that is like, that's the, when we stop there, that's the problem, I think.
Right. Like, there are more meaningful reviews of Marvel movies as a cultural happening than any Marvel movie. And like, those reviews have affected me more than any Marvel movie.
Exactly.
And yeah, it's that pendulum again, swinging back and forth.
I'm that person who's like, no, I do want to read about the weird art piece that I haven't ever seen.
Right. No, and like,
a little bit. Like, it's there. Like, it's hard because when the art is about, when it's experiential art, that's very hard, right? Which is what games are. They are experiential, and it's very hard to describe an experience to someone in a way that is interesting. And so that can be very difficult. But I also want everybody to make weird little zines about that one game they played that one time that they don't know the name of at their friend's house when they were 17 or whatever it is, right? Like, this just like nicher and nicher and nicher is, I'm into that as well. All and of these things should exist.
Right. Like, there's an ecosystem, right? Like, the person that's writing that review of the mainstream thing is also probably making that weird little zine and doing a gallery show, and maybe eventually they'll do 20 gallery shows and then they will have a retrospective and then it becomes something that's mainstream that someone else is doing the commentary on. Yeah, we are not on a desert island. We don't have to choose just one game to talk about. So
I think that's a good point, like, in the sense that, like, then people's reactions is in their specificity is the interesting thing, right? Like, you know, like, what, how are people actually like dealing with this? What are they thinking? What kind of art do they want to make? I definitely think that's the interesting stuff. You know, it's just that, like, even this ties into the podcast, right? Like, why did people start listening to RTFM when you were talking about GURPS? It was probably because of GURPS, right? Not because of RTFM. But now when you talk about something small, they listen to it because they're interested in your opinions, or they like how you like talk about stuff. And even if they haven't heard of the game, they listen. And I think it's that kind of push and pull of, like, you know, like drawing you in terms of here's this cultural touchstone that we have, or versus like, hey, now I can talk about something weirder and you'll come along with me on the journey, I think.
Yeah, you thought you liked GURPS, but actually you like indie games.
And I think, like, that's other smarter people than I have said it, but like, that's the role of the critic, right? Is not to be right all the time, but is to be someone that you, there are many of them, and you find one that kind of aligns with your views, but is also a little to the side of them so that they're pulling you along and maybe like engaging you into something you didn't know about, but you like their voice, you understand where they're coming from, and you are reading them because of their like role and their artistic ability as a critic, not because they're covering the stuff you want to see covered well.
Yeah, we're not promoters.
Yeah.
Which is, and I think,
unless you pay us.
Yeah.
We do have ads sometimes.
I do think, yeah, I think that's one of the things that I think is often actually missing from critique of games and like largely TTRPGs. I think video games has a few stronger voices in this, but like who you are as a person and your perspective is the interesting thing that you bring to a critique. Like that, the more personal it is, I think people try to be objective. Like that's even possible for human beings to be about an art medium. Like whatever, get out of here with that. But leading into the subjectivity, if we have any strength, it's that from the get-go, we were like, we are going to be super subjective. You either like us or you hate us. But if you like the weird people that we are, we have 2 years of weird people for you to listen to. But it is like, because that for me is like, you know, it's very important that we look at like we look at socio-political elements of games because those are present, right? That for me, how queerness interacts with games is one of the interesting things about games. And that is super personal. And a lot of people will be like, well, that's not objective. That's not, you know, universal, as if there is a universal experience also. And I think that I would love to see more people who are even reviewing like games to just get really personal about where they sit in the world and what that perspective brings to their engagement with games. Cause it's always there. It's just whether or not you're acknowledging it. Right. And yeah.
I think if I could get it to fit, 2 years of listening to weird people would have been the title of this episode now.
That's going to be Max's book in 4 years that he puts out as part of the research.
4 years of talking to one weird person.
Okay. So in the first section, which is called Infectious Enthusiasm, I ask, what's a game that you've had a lot of fun with that you want to recommend?
I'm happy to go first, if that's okay. I've pushed it multiple times. I will continue to push it. Sagas of the Icelanders by Gregor Vuga was one of the first generations of PBTA hacks spinoffs. I am 15 or 20 sessions deep into running it for two other players. It is much further from Apocalypse World than contemporary PBTA games like maybe Thirsty Sword Lesbians, which I like, but like this is something that took Apocalypse World and like took out combat and like made it a very specific cultural thing. It's really interesting. It's really conscious of history and gender. Like, I know Viking shit is a real big red flag for a lot of people in the rise of the alt-right and everything, but this is about like farmers in Iceland in the 10th century. And, you know, I see people talk about Monster Hearts, rightfully. I see people talk about other like early gen PBTA stuff. This one just seems to live quietly off in its little hovel on the Icelandic plains, but I really enjoy it, and I think it is worth looking at if you are at all interested in gender in games or making PBTA stuff.
I'm tempted. I've had many, many fun games, and recently they have been actually kind of contained to Thirsty Sword Lesbians. So I'm a little tempted to say Thirsty Sword Lesbians, even though it's directly riffing off of Aaron's. But I also... Thirsty Sword Lesbians, I don't want to be all PBTA all the time. And so I think I want to go back to a game that I played a long time ago called Blood Feud, because it's not one that people talk about a whole lot. There's lots of games I've had a great time in, Barkeeps of the Borderlands, whatever, Tunnel Goons, all of them. There are many fabulous games out there. And Blood Feud is one that I want, that I keep thinking about wanting to go back and play more, but it's so specific in what it's doing that I feel like it'll be... It's always kind of hard because it's not necessarily always a fun game, and also has a lot of really like interesting relationships to gender in particular, because that is the statement it's trying to make. It's like a pseudo toxic masculinity simulator, but more fun than that. Yeah. And so I don't even know, like, some of the things that are fun about it are, or some of the things that I think are great about it are not even fun necessarily, but it pops up in my head quite a lot about games that are doing the thing that I want games to do, which is like picking a very specific statement to make and then carrying that statement through all of every element of the thing, of its creation.
And what's interesting about those answers is that those two games actually have a lot in common.
They do. Yeah, it's the same time. It's the same general geographic region.
We also both like historical fiction and fantasy a lot. So that's not,
We hate talking about gender, which is weird that we pick.
Yeah. We hate gender. Love historical fiction.
Okay. In the next section, Tyranny of Numbers, I ask, is there a number or statistic that you can share from your work that you think will be useful to my listeners?
Well, so statistics are one of those things where I'm like, oh, what's interesting? Do you want to talk about our podcast metrics? Because I'm just proud of them. But no, the thing that I could think of that was kind of interesting from my games is that my smallest and most experimental game is my most downloaded game, which is not a specific statistic. It's, I don't know, it has like 4,500 downloads or something, which to me is a lot, but it is not Himbos, which I think is the game that people mostly associate me with. It is Frame 352, which is like an extremely experimental photo coin flipping game that I just made up out of my brain as opposed to hacking something else. And it is a pocket folding zine. And it's the one that people are like, yes, I want to. The reason I chose downloads here is because I think that views and shares and all that stuff doesn't actually like talk about engagement. Like there's much more of an intention to play a game when you actually download it than even if you purchase it. Or what, that's what I feel like I've seen from behind the scenes in Itch is people that those downloads is like, oh, you want to read it. And that might mean you're actually playing it, which is very different than a lot of the other metrics kicking around. But I was going to do a math of like pages per downloads and this would win, but it's, yeah, it was mainly just that my smallest, weirdest game is also my most downloaded game. So make more small, weird games.
Who came up with a really good title for that game?
Some jerk. Some jerk named Aaron King.
I don't know.
I'm terrible at naming things, so I frequently am like, Aaron, please give me some words. You words.
It's the frame of the famous Bigfoot picture.
Yeah.
Where he was captured. Oh. My stupid number is that I have uploaded 80 games to itch.io.
Amazing. What?
Some are not games. Some are like my favorite book zines. I do a yearly zine about my favorite books. But yeah, a lot of them are now restricted or hidden because they were very bad when I uploaded them and I regretted them. But I, you know, Max very kindly is like, oh, you're such a good writer. But I have hidden all my worst writings. But yeah, 80 different itch pages. I think I just really want people to like make a thing inspired by their passion. And I want them to, I say this as someone who spent the first half or two thirds, three fourths, I'm 40 now, three fourths of my life talking about making things and never making them. And so I think I'm making up for lost time. And now I'm just like, if you have an idea, figure out how to make it and finish it in the least frictionable way there is and just put it out there. And I that is like a position of privilege. Like I have time, I have internet access, I have computers. So part of that is also like, I want to help people get access to those things if they need them, help them break projects down in ways that will lead to them actually finishing things. But like, I just love the idea of someone getting an idea and being able to go, okay, it's been a week, I've worked on it, here it is. And then if they're embarrassed about it a year later, being able to hide it from all the internet. Yeah, I want to say like, oh, just make stuff. But I know that's often like a live, laugh, love, like follow your dreams sort of thing. And a lot of people don't have access to that, like myself included. Like mental health stuff has been a huge barrier for me to finishing things. And so when I say, oh, make stuff, part of that is like, let's find you a community. Let's figure out ways to get you progressing on whatever you want to work on and like get it out there, because that I've learned like as much struggling with that stuff as I did in any of the many schools I talked about dropping out of. So
I'm looking forward to the Aaron King retrospective.
It's gonna be three pages because I will be embarrassed about all the rest
of it. We get to see all 80 games.
I'll do it. If this, if go subscribe to the Yes Indeed Patreon, and if we get twice the followers, twice the subscribers, I will unhide all of my games.
I will say that Aaron, the Aaron King retrospective won't be necessarily done by you. Like it will.
Oh, right. Thank God.
It won't be like talk about your work for 800 pages.
Yeah, I need those subscriptions to happen so that I can download everything for that brief window where it's unlocked again, and then make the retrospective.
In the next section, replay, I ask, is there a story or anecdote that you've heard about someone else playing your game, or even if you were running your game or something like that, that you'd like to share?
I was thinking about this, and I was like, oh, there's some great moments that I've had in games that I've been playing. But also, in one of the cool things about Frame 352 getting popular is that people, because the game asks you to share your photos, like you take photos and then you share them, and so I actually got to see people making Twitter threads of their playthroughs that wasn't just they're making a story about a cryptid, but also was their photography. And I've said this a number of times, but not here. I was a photographer professionally for like a decade and some before I entered game stuff. And so getting to see people play the game and also engage with the medium of photography through the game was really rad. Gontijo, who is a really amazing visual graphic designer for a lot of RPGs, did a playthrough, and there's like one photo that he posted that is this very blurry night photo that he also put what I assume is a fake like zoom 10 times little text tag in the corner so it looked like more diegetic, and it's great. I love that one. I think you can hunt down that thread. But also there was that time that Aaron ripped their shirt arms off when playing Himbos on a stream. I was on that stream, so that one shouldn't count. But Aaron did fully rip their... I have the arms, and then it mailed
me. I was going to say, I sent them to you, right?
I still have them. The leftover plaid arms. I'm going to frame them someday. And if you want to know of a way to make your friends feel very warm and fuzzy, it is to rip your clothing off while playing their games. It's the only way to do it.
There's an all VTuber actual play of my game Patchwork World on YouTube. It's called It's Up to You Really. The GM goes by Darling Demon Eclipse at D Demon Eclipse on Twitter. She's probably somewhere else now. Twitter is dying, but it's all VTubers, which I love. I am old, as I mentioned, but I was like, I want to be a VTuber now. Just seeing these people play it with their animated avatars was so cool, and I was so honored. And it was just very much like the kids are all right, and like they're like making games as well that are going to be better than any game I've ever made. And so I'm just excited for the youth, and that was very nice of them, and it was cool. And there were moments where I was like touched by the character arcs, and there were moments where I was like, oh, they're engaging with these mechanics in a way I didn't imagine. Like, all the cool parts were in them, not in anything that I built into the game. So thank you. It's cool if you want to go watch it.
Okay. In the last section, all advice is advice for myself. I ask, what's a habit or technique you're trying to get better at the table?
I remembered one, and it's a bad one. I'm trying to plan more for games. I'm trying to do more prep. The low prep, it's good. It freed me. It freed many people. But then I just found myself feeling lazy, getting lazy. And I thought back to all the fun plans that I had made ahead of time that when I revealed, my players enjoyed. So again, pendulums. I'm getting back into planning. I'm pulling it back the other way. Not heavy planning, just like 10 minutes.
Oh, 10 minutes to me is what I mean when I say no prep. Like, I still think about stuff. Like, it's not, I don't actually go in not knowing.
Oh, I go full mind empty most of the
what
time.
What a twist to be like, I'm going back to prep and I mean 10 minutes. What does that even mean?
I feel like mine is actually the opposite. Like, the more I play, the more I'm trying to make myself as not present as possible. Not like disassociating, but like trying to flip it as much as possible so that I'm not impacting what's happening for a game that I'm GMing, which happens frequently, right? Like, it's different. That question is so different. I am trying to be less present as a GM by kicking it back to players just as often as possible. And I'm trying to be softer as a player. And
we're just like two ships passing in the night, constantly becoming each other and then back again.
Luckily, we can never, we should co-GM someday. It'll be really weird.
No, if we ever met in person or did like the same thing, it would be like matter and antimatter touching.
That's true.
Well, thank you both so much for those great answers. I really appreciate it. What links or where do you want to send my listeners to? Is there a specific place other than the podcast, which I will definitely link to? Is there anything else you'd like to plug?
Yeah, I think it's just rtfmcast.com, and that will send you to our podcast. Our There's Discord links to weird. Both of us, I think, in every episode description, and to our Discord, the RTFM Discord.
I enjoy it in the time of the internet collapse. It feels like a nice place to be. It's been recently encouraging of the fact that I'm making a solo LARP out of a theremin, and I feel like if you can find a group of people that tell you that that is a good way to spend your time, you should hold on to them.
Thanks for listening, folks. Next week, we'll be sitting down and talking about RPG Awards with the folks behind the awards. It's going to be fun. See you then.
And cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.